Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Fast Funny Women, 75 Essays of Flash Nonfiction, edited by Gina Barreca, narrated by Cindy Kay and Allison Johnson. Introduction. Gina Barreca. She makes a story out of everything. A Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist, a TV megastar, two members of the American Academy of Poets, four accomplished stand-up comics, a director of a Center for African-American Poetry and Poetics at the University of Pittsburgh, a director of the Women's Campaign School at Yale, three award-winning screenwriters, two New Yorker cartoonists, a commander of the British Empire, and a whole coven of New York Times bestsellers walk into a book. The book they're in? It's the one you're listening to now. These women were invited to join others between the ages of 19 and 87, including surgeons, gardeners, teachers, attorneys, artists, psychologists, booksellers, caretakers, and bodily fluid handlers, to be a part of Fast Funny Women. Some writers are household names, and some are seeing their work published in print for the first time. Each contributor individually accepted the invitation with alacrity. Their dance cards might have been full, but these women still made room to write. The majority, including many of the most established and celebrated authors, wrote original pieces specifically for this collection. Every woman here wrote about her real life. Some pieces are shocking. Some are adorable. Some are weird. Some are vicious. Some are sentimental. Some are sexy. And all are funny. There are wheelchairs, movie stars, sisters, Holocaust survivors, tampons, kisses, trials, boxing matches, blizzards, grandchildren, doilies, dildos, and death. The writers here exemplify women about whom have been said, ever since Eve freed us from Eden. Her? That one? She makes a story out of everything. Listeners will find that the complications, satisfactions, and frustrations of women's lives are unflinchingly examined by writers who trace the split between the vision of a woman's life, as put forth by the social script, and the way actual human beings live as women. Most funny women become funny because they have to. I grew up funny because it was the only way for a loud, smart girl to make herself heard. I also realized that to get people to pay attention, you had to do a version of yelling over a backyard fence, making sure your voice was distinct from the other ones coming from all the other windows. Humor and defiance held the two ends of the jump rope when I was a kid in Brooklyn. They worked in tandem. A smart line coupled with a great image grabbed my imagination as soon as I learned to read. I cut my teeth on Jean Kerr and Irma Bombeck, whose books I loved while still in elementary school. By sixth grade, I graduated to Anita Loos and Dorothy Parker. Outrage, insight, and originality swept me into books when I was a girl. In graduate school, I was surprised to discover that nobody had charted women's literary work from this perspective. I was sort of amazed, but not too amazed. When I went to my advisory committee and told them, "I'd like to do my dissertation on humor in women's writing," they said, "Well, there is no humor in women's writing." And I was like, "Nah, I think you're wrong." That was a long time ago. Yet, every 5 years or so, I'll suddenly hear from magazines, television producers, or podcast editors asking, in all seriousness, whether women have a sense of humor. This question apparently has a regular orbit, like a rogue planet in a pink tutu. Maybe we need reminders of what's real, the way we need to be reminded to eat legumes, or know that pets can help us live longer, or understand that violence is not a terrific way to solve relationship problems. But it nevertheless seems odd to reaffirm that women's humor exists, because if you look at any random group of women for more than 13 seconds, you'll notice we're laughing. There's always laughter coming out of a women's room. There's rarely laughter coming out of the men's room. When there's laughter coming out of the single-occupancy, gender-neutral restroom, it probably means somebody's reading in there. With any luck, they're reading this book. What women are laughing about in the restroom isn't a new joke. It probably doesn't involve a trick whereby a woman attempts to dry her genitals with the warm air blower attached to the wall. And neither, would I bet, does it depend on the ritual holding of the least physically robust woman over the toilet bowl while the other ladies yell, "Dunk, dunk," in unison. When women are laughing, we're not telling jokes. We're telling stories, We're talking about what happened to us that day. Our lives are a riot. But the funny parts still don't get discussed often enough. Or when they are discussed, they're judged by men. Not to be funny, because they don't involve the dunk or, dare I say, the hot air. Humor works by approaching topics nobody else wants to touch. It embraces taboo subjects. What's taboo for women is different from what's taboo for men, and therefore, women's humor is going to be different from men's. That's why this book exists. There is no such thing as an ordinary life. The best comedy doesn't trivialize, but instead emphasizes, italicizes, and puts into bold the individual moments from which all significant stories are made. Funny stories are part of every culture, and women's humor, like the humor of any group historically disenfranchised, is proof of the power of unintended consequences. Humor is a byproduct of life, like happiness. It's what happens when you're doing something else. As convener of the gathering and as editor, I set three boundaries. The pieces had to be under 750 words. They had to be funny. They had to be creative nonfiction. Creative nonfiction being a phrase along the lines of one size fits all. It hangs differently on everybody, and for some, it's a loose fit. Stories, regardless of length, live or die on details. These brief and snug works are as complete and as self-enclosed as eggs. Although they're about a specific moment, feeling, or idea, each tale also happens to be framed by 5,000 years of other women's lives. Like any good story you've never heard or read before, you'll recognize it immediately. The audacity, resilience, intelligence, and playfulness. A deep sense of skepticism and a deep sense of delight will conjure a call and response of your own. By addressing what's meaningful in life, refusing to ignore it, dismiss it, repress it, or atone for it. The writings here run towards what's frightening, worrying, or shameful in our lives without hesitation. Everybody has felt this way, done a version of this, gone through it, come out of it, and triumphed over it. We're lifting the rugs that others have swept under for generations, or maybe just revealing the mess we made ourselves. Writing it down is the opposite of covering it up. You get your deposit back on whatever weirdness happens. Writers know that experience is only a first draft. The future is a vault into which today's details are deposited, to be withdrawn later on and, when examined with compassion, amusement, and curiosity, made into a story. Telling a funny story doesn't diminish the significance of the event, but instead changes the script. The fear of being laughed at becomes precisely what makes others laugh. You're the narrator, and you have control over it. It becomes your story, as opposed to something that happened to you. The 75 pieces in this collection make a playground of the thin overlay of social soil covering the minefields of disaffection, marginalization, rejection, betrayal, and loss that are the emotional and intellectual landscape of women. That's the fun part. If you recognize the landscape, you'll see the different ways these writings are tilting it. You'll see the new ways they're making new maps or erasing borders entirely. They're seeing large subjects through small lenses, as all writers of short pieces must. But their fanatic attention to detail mustn't be mistaken for an appetite for minutia when it is, in fact, a passion for sharply focused observation. All good writing reflects and illuminates life. Fast, Funny Women holds up a compact mirror. In it, you'll see yourself. With luck, you'll laugh. How Gumbo Was My Valley. Lisa Landry. I grew up in a middle-class neighborhood 20 miles from the French Quarter, hundreds of miles from pretension, and decades from helicopter parenting. It was the 1970s. Seatbelts were optional. Kids rode in the back of pickup trucks. Helmets were something only Evel Knievel wore. Adults happily dispensed bottle rockets to everyone over the age of 5 each New Year's Eve and 4th of July. But bottles weren't necessary for launching them. Your hand worked almost as well, give or take a second-degree burn or partially blown-off finger. One day, the community golf course in the middle of our neighborhood closed. Previously manicured acres became our labyrinthine playground. Golf cart paths turned into go-kart tracks. We jumped dirt bikes over sand traps and raced bikes with banana seats through 18 former holes, repurposed as mountains and castles. We defended from each other playing battle. We were free-range kids building our own adolescent after school, unlimited nights and weekend minutes, utopic dystopia. Each October, the firefighters at the end of my street transformed their station into a haunted house. Our community swim club hosted a weekly kids-only swim during summer. The parents planned next year's Mardi Gras all year long. Folks knew how to prioritize. Everybody knew each other. The black family two streets over threw block parties. The Cajun grandma near Old Hole 4 sold spicy homemade crab cakes. A Bolivian dad jogged through the neighborhood every night. His daughter and I became best friends. Our neighborhood was one of hospitality and inclusion, despite the systemic racial inequality we never pretended didn't exist. On Friday nights, neighborhood dads drank beers at the edge of my parents' driveway. Sometimes they'd smoke pot. We could tell they were about to smoke when my dad told us to go inside and watch TV. Nobody wanted their kids inside the house in the 70s. If your parents told you to go inside and they stayed outside, they wanted to smoke pot. The Episcopal church we attended was 15 miles away from home, and my mom has always been a devout worshiper of the God of convenience. So when the Vatican built an outpost across the street from my house, St. Martha's, she decided we were turning Catholic. It's the same Jesus, just closer. I don't think we got saved, but we did get another half hour of sleep and pancakes instead of cereal on Sunday mornings. Praise God. St. Martha's sprang for a gargantuan concrete parking lot, providing every neighborhood kid with a huge, flat, outdoor skating rink / go-kart racetrack, except for during choir practice or mass. Then we kids endured the trials and tribulations because the parishioners hogged up our roller boogie / Grand Prix with their dumbass real cars, decimating our circuit. Forced to skate and race among rows of cars, we did our best to avoid creating too many dents in them or us. The church also threw an annual weekend-long festival on that parking lot. Bright lights bled through my window curtains. Live bands performed. A DJ played records. And volunteer parishioner chefs smoked chickens in barbecue pits. The scent accosted my nostrils, giving me a 72-hour chicken Jones. I could hear people laughing and singing all weekend long. I loved it. I felt like I was at Woodstock. The festival always closed with a talent show. One year, my dad and his friends performed in drag. My father was Dolly Parton. The dad next door was Barbara Mandrell. And Bolivian jogger dad was Cher. Together, they sang Here You Come Again very, very badly. I looked over at Father Perkovich. He seemed to be mouthing a prayer for them, but the audience enjoyed the spectacle. They won second place. Dad proudly placed his trophy in the living room, on the mantel next to Mom's statue of St. Jiffy. Then the 80s came, and the divorces began. It was a slow burn at first. Kids started not showing up to race or shoot bottle rockets. They'd moved away when their parents broke up. There were fewer dads drinking beers on my driveway. Then no dads. Moms had tag sales, lowball pricing the ugly ties our friends' dads used to wear, and their rusty golf clubs that also hadn't seen any action since the golf course closed. When my parents separated, my mom had a yard sale too and sold my dad's trophy for a quarter. St. Martha's canceled its annual festival due to low attendance. My utopic dystopia Woodstock was no more. Whole cloth. Mimi Pond. In the mid-1960s, I'd come home from grade school in San Diego, slap my man from Uncle Lunchbox on the kitchen table, and find my grandmother smoking and clutching newspaper clippings sent from her sisters in Arkansas. Their adult children's wedding announcements published in the Petty Jean Country headline. There were grainy black-and-white photos of my mother's first cousins, all younger than she. Young men with brush cuts and military uniforms. Ingenues with big early 1960s hairdos, gazing thoughtfully over their satin-shrouded shoulders. My grandmother would read them aloud. The bride wore a fingertip-length veil of Alençon lace. Her floor-length, empire-waisted gourd gown was ivory silk gazar with touches of seed pearls, a sweetheart neckline, and short sleeves. Ivory opera-length gloves added a cosmopolitan touch. This was followed by detailed descriptions of, well, everything. The bridesmaids' dresses, the mother of the bride's outfit, the bouquets, the boutonnieres, the floral arrangements for the table settings, who the guests were, where they'd traveled from, and, at the end, a description of the bride's going-away suit. Summer weight, pale green boucle, if you must know, with a matching hat and shoes. To my grandmother, always in some way disappointed by life, all this meant was that things were so much better back there, and it was all going on without her. While my grandmother was yearning for home, my brain was being titillated by all these fabric names. Plissé, Peau de Soie, Dupioni, Crepe de Chine, File, Charmeuse. Words like these were once the coin of the realm in newspaper wedding announcements from coast to coast. In these olden days, a woman's name was meant to appear in the newspapers only twice in her life, when she got married and when she died. Once married, she'd be referred to by her husband's name, Mrs. Charles Buchanan, Mrs. Philip Longstock, Mrs. William C. Kimbrough. A husband's name was the best defense against anything, women having no agency. If you weren't going to be called by your own name again until they dug a hole for you, at least this wedding reportage was like a kind of temple, the fabric name supporting the narrative like Corinthian columns. Or was it a tomb? Look, it's not the fault of fabrics that they've been used by the patriarchy. The names are dizzying. Gingham, dotted Swiss, gabardine, organza, taffeta, baize, cretonne, chambray, bombazine, dimity. Words that roll around inside your brain like loose marbles. Maybe I was hooked when my grandmother showed me this sense of promise in the yardage department at JCPenney. So many colors and patterns and textures. The trims and ribbons, buttons and thread, zippers and snaps were called notions. The pattern books transported you to a heretofore unknown world of style and glamour, and I had my own personal tailoress to do my bidding. Of course she was disappointed when I failed to take sewing myself. That white peak tennis dress, an eighth-grade home economics project, one long seam-ripping struggle from beginning to end, was my Waterloo. What stayed with me was the words, easier to stitch together. Their sounds and their origins give text color and depth. Aside from being a repository of fabric names, I also know all the words for kinds of garments, and parts of garments, and things attached to garments. Shrugs, boleros, chubbies, dirndls, sheaths, hostess pajamas, toreador pants, capris, petal pushers, raglan sleeves, modesty panels, peplums, passementerie, epaulettes, dickies and knickers and capes, oh my. I thought everyone knew these. But not everyone grew up in the 1960s and 1970s, with a grandmother who sewed and a brain that memorizes words the way others memorize baseball statistics. Who wouldn't love them? A garage sale philistine, that's who. The sign announced, Costumer's Yard Sale, Vintage Wear. I swerved to the curb and made a beeline to the young woman presiding. How much is that brocade car coat over there? I asked breathlessly. I don't know what you're talking about, she said coolly. The brocade coat on the fence, how much is it? I don't know what brocade is. The gauntlet, which is a glove, had been thrown. You're in costuming, I said, narrowing my eyes. And you don't know the names of fabrics? I just know what I like, she answered with hauteur. There would be no deal that day. That woman did not have a notion. Memories of a Boxing Broad. Amy Leonard Gaynor. On the day Angelo Dundee, renowned trainer of Muhammad Ali and Sugar Ray Leonard, died in 2012, my big brother Jeff and I reminisced about our grandpa Abe, who owned a diner near Dundee's Fifth Street Gym in Miami Beach. Years earlier, during our Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn childhood, Grandpa Abe never missed the Friday night fights, teaching Jeff as a toddler about the fistic science. Jeff, in turn, taught me. Our Grandpa Sam lived nearby and had fought as an amateur. That double dose of boxing DNA landed me a job covering boxing for Sports Phone, and then the granddaddy of sports publications, Sports Illustrated, in the 1980s. The news about Dundee sparked more than a touch of nostalgia about my halcyon years as a Cub reporter. I rifled through my boxing tapes, looking for my interview with Dundee that I conducted before one of Sugar Ray's title fights. And I found it. If I could only find my old reel-to-reel tape recorder to listen to it. It's probably somewhere near my Betamax. I read the faded names on the tapes. Hey, here's lightweight champion Ray Boom Boom Mancini. I'd traveled by bus with the New York newspaper guys to Mancini's training camp. In the camp's ladies' room, I ran into the only other female with the entourage, the reigning penthouse pet of the year. Dressed in a leopard print bathing suit and awaiting her photo shoot with Mancini, she tugged at her suit in front of a full-length mirror, something I'd go at all lengths to avoid. She was getting more agitated with each tug. Do I look fat? She asked me. Fat? You look fine, I assured her, while thinking, there is absolutely no hope for the rest of us. Where were my tapes of the 3 hours I spent at Mitch Blood Green's mom's house in Queens? He was a 6'5" heavyweight, and I was there to ask about his upcoming bout with Mike Tyson. But he just wanted my advice on women. A year later, I was shocked to awake to a news report that Mitch Blood Green had been arrested while impersonating a gas station attendant and robbing cars until the cops showed up. Not my blood, I thought. Surely that must be some other blood. Ah, my Jerry Cooney tape looked intact. Too bad Jerry didn't look that way after his fight against Michael Spinks. A few days before the fight, I ran into Jerry at the Atlantic City Hotel lobby. Alone. An exclusive. No throngs of reporters. I asked him if he had some time to chat. He said to come to his room in 10 minutes, where he'd be getting a massage. I quickly did the math. Massage equals one massagee and one masseuse. Two people. Whew. Sure, I said confidently. When I entered Jerry's room, he lay on a table with just a small towel draped over his 6'6" frame. He started talking, but not about boxing. Then resignedly switched gears when I started asking about overhand rights and left hooks. I should have included remember to duck. And where was my tape with that heavyweight, whose name I'm still afraid to mention, given that he was part of an investigative mission I was part of to get the goods on a no-good-nick boxing agent? When I arrived at the desolate place the heavyweight had chosen to meet, he was flanked by two equally large men, arms folded, all eyes on me. Where did you get my number? One of his henchmen asked me. I'd been told explicitly not to reveal my source. So I hummin' it, Jackie Gleason style, trying hard not to picture the New York Post headline. Day 12. Sports Illustrated reporter still missing. What's this? My tape from a New York Rangers game? My boss had asked if I could fill in for the hockey reporter. Put me in, coach, I said while thinking, oy vey. Remembering that hockey players do their post-game interviews in a locker room, usually nude. At least Jerry Cooney had a towel. In that locker room, I kept my microphone and eyes up. I never longed more for another female face. Even the penthouse pet would have been welcome. Just let me survive this locker room and get back to my comfort zone, I remember thinking. Back to boxing, a civilized sport where men kept their clothes on. The sport my grandpa Abe taught us to love. Making a Girl, Gianna Hoyer. Age 10. Hey girl, love your French braid. She seems nice. New friend? Age 11. Hey girl, can I get a taste of that? He doesn't seem like he's talking about my gummy bears. Adults are weird. Age 13. Hey girl, you look so grown up. Come over here and talk to me for a minute. Bald spot, check. Weird hand movement in pocket, clocked. I'm not a grown-up, but I'm not an idiot. I know what's up. I'm out. Age 15. Hey, girl, you know what I could do with an ass like that? It's cute, right? Swim team has really put me in fighting shape. Age 17. Hey, girl, show us more of what you got. Hold on, let me just grab my boombox and put this stripper song on. Okay, I am ready to take it all off. Age 18. Hey girl, come on over. Give us a little something. I am Oz the All-Powerful. For you, empathy. For you, integrity. For you, my favorite. Respect. Age 20. Hey girl, you're so beautiful, you should smile more. I would, but people like you make it impossible. Age 22. Hey girl, you have gorgeous eyes. Brilliant observation. I hadn't looked in the mirror the last 22 years. If I hadn't met you, I may have never known. Thank you. Age 24. Hey girl, nice tits. Come to daddy. I haven't had a daddy since I was 12 years old. My daddy also liked to talk about my great tits with his friends. It was awesome. Exactly what every 12-year-old girl wants to hear from her father. A real gift. Just like this interaction with you. Age 26. Hey, girl, you know you're hot, right? Why don't you stop and hang out? Fine, keep walking, bitch. You're not that cute. But now that you've yelled at me and called me a bitch, I think I'm in love. Age 28. Hey, girl, looking good. Cool, Ivan. I just need to get around you to the printer. Age 30. Hey, girl, you married, huh? I could give you a little side piece. Well, I married for love, but I've got a lot of student debt. How's bigamy sound to you? I could use a rich husband. Age 32. Hey, girl, can I hit that? This is the closest we've come to the truth. Believe me, the assault has been real. Consider me hit. Age 35. Hey, girl, you got what I want. Yeah, I know. Age 35. Hey, girl, you're glowing. Love the look. You are pulling it off. Thank you? Did I startle you? I get it, girl. Take the compliment. We can feel good about how we look, at least with each other. Yes, girl. Yes. She seems nice. New friend? That sounds awful. The art of self-care. Lily Shell. Have you ever told a doctor about a past medical experience you've had, expecting a nod of affirmation or a smile of gentle pity, only to have the doctor look absolutely horrified and choke out a shocked, "That sounds awful"? Ever since I was hospitalized for a few days earlier this year with a rare infection, I have. I'd never been in a hospital before, and I bided my time waiting for recovery, envisioning the day I would spring back to life with sage advice to dispense and a zest for life, like a character in a Victorian novel sent to the countryside to improve her constitution. It didn't quite play out that way. I have anxiety, and the experience of being that sick really did a number not only on my body, but also on my mental health. It also, for better or worse, gave me a lot of practice in the ultimate millennial art form, the art of self-care. A lot of the language of self-care has sadly been co-opted by the corporate wellness industry, which wants us to distract ourselves with face masks and bubble baths while other, more important things are going on, like structural attacks against marginalized people of all kinds. But honestly, some friends sent me overpriced nail polish, and it put me in a really good mood. It helped to feel that some part of me looked nice while my body felt like it was in disrepair. Other things that helped in this specific Instagrammable way included taking exorbitantly long hot showers, the aforementioned face masks, scented candles, and a plethora of at-once soothing and invigorating reality TV fare. Especially given the cultural prevalence of the nail polish and face masks version of self-care, it's easy to conflate self-care with positivity, even levity. When I first got home from the hospital, it felt great to laugh with my friends on the phone about the ridiculousness of my situation. I'll spare you the details, but it did involve my butt. To be honest, laughing about it was the mode I gravitated toward the most. I didn't want to dwell on my negative feelings. I wanted to come across as independent and capable. However, when independent and capable me took center stage, she left scared, sick, and cranky me to wreak havoc behind the scenes. I found myself starting to get resentful of friends for not reaching out soon enough or often enough or with the right tone. Of course, this in turn made me feel confused and guilty. I wanted them to read my mind, which is obviously impossible as far as we know. But more than that, I definitely didn't want them to know that I wanted them to read my mind, lest I come across as, God forbid, needing something. Coming to that realization was the nudge I needed to start taking better care of myself emotionally. I started pushing myself to reach out more to friends when I was feeling sad or stressed or otherwise bad about my situation. Now, when I have a paranoid flashback because something in my body feels slightly off, I let them know so they can gently but firmly remind me, as best friends do, that getting off WebMD is sometimes the utmost form of self-care. Already somewhat of a hypochondriac before this illness, I experience a bizarre combination of emotions when a doctor looks me square in the eye after hearing all of it and says, "That sounds awful." There's the usual self-pity and underlying fear, but mixed with a newer, curious sensation. Something like pride. The foremost expression of this is a particular kind of pride, honestly probably bordering on smugness, that I made it through an experience that apparently makes...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?